Samurai. It's an impossible situation. You stay here till he comes. I know him. He'll understand, replied the woman. From that time forth, they didn't exchange another word about Count Valievsky. They waited, till one day a telegram came from him. He was coming on such and such an evening. They went to meet him at the station. Two guards lifted him out of the carriage, and a porter came along with a wheelchair. He was put in the wheelchair. He held out his long, bony, yellow face towards his wife. She bent down and kissed him. With long, bony hands that were blue with cold, he kept trying, unsuccessfully, to pull a couple of brown rugs over his knees. Farmeria came to his aid. The Count was wheeled along the platform like one of his many pieces of luggage. He had to be lifted into the car. Farmeria and the chauffeur did it together. He had to be carried into the villa. Farmeria took him by the head and shoulders. The servant took his feet.
I'm hungry, said Count Valievsky.
When they laid the table, they learned that Valievsky was unable to feed himself. His wife had to feed him. And when, following a grim, silent dinner, it was time for bed, the Count said,
I'm tired. Put me to bed.
Countess Valievska, the servant and Farmeria bundled the Count up the stairs to his room on the first floor, where a bed had been made ready. Good night, said Farmeria. He saw, out of the corner of his eye, his mistress plump up the pillows and sit down on the side of the bed. And then Farmeria left. Nothing has ever been heard of him since.
Ian Glenn was reading Station Master Farmeria by Josef Roth, translated by Michael Hoffman. It was abridged and produced by Emma Harding. Well, a very warm welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall in London from me, Susie Klein. We are live on Radio 3 for this evening's prom, the first of two concerts here tonight given by the Budapest Festival Orchestra under founder conductor Ivan Fischer. We've just one work left on the bill for this concert. It's the first symphony by a composer Ivan Fischer feels a deep musical and personal connection with, Gustav Mahler.
It is, of course, very stunning to know that both European premieres, actually, of this piece were a huge fiasco.
Well, apologies there. We played slightly the wrong clip. I think in our excitement, we played you something from Dejan Lazic, who was on earlier. I think we're going to try and see if that clip's ready for you to listen to now.
He comes from the same background, this kind of Austro-Hungarian, assimilated, Jewish surroundings where people stepped out of religion and culture became their religion. So they threw themselves at cultural values with the same obsession and fanatism as to religion a few generations earlier. This is a very clearly recognizable little subculture in Central Europe. And what I read of Mahler is very much like my own family. It's really extremely similar. Now, that may be one explanation, but I think it goes deeper than that. I'm probably the same type of neurotic, strange person. I really don't know. I see a lot of craze in Mahler's music in a good sense, and I get very excited, and I find most of his unpredictable twists completely predictable. So I don't know how else to explain the link. It's intuitive.
What for you is Mahler trying to get us to feel and to think? And how does he want us
to
respond?
It's his own soul. I think Mahler was a person with extreme emotions, extreme feelings. And when the music seemed pale to him or it didn't correspond to his a scale of emotions, what he wanted to express. He was an extreme personality, and he needed extreme sounds and effects, also musical contrasts, to say what he wanted to say, which was his very honest expression of himself. I think Mahler has an enormous following now everywhere. And if you really ask the question, why is that? Why is Mahler so popular compared to maybe 50 or 80 years ago, when he even seemed somebody who was slightly tasteless, you know, like somebody suspicious and not really good enough? My answer would be that people discovered his honesty.
Ivan Fischer on Mahler, such an ardent fan, this conductor, of this composer. He calls him one of the great geniuses of music history. So here he is to conduct Mahler's first symphony with his orchestra, the Budapest Festival Orchestra.
Thank you. Ivan Fischer, conducting Mahler's first symphony without a score. By the end of that, all the brass players, all the winds on their feet, blasting that music out into the Royal Albert Hall. That piece, such an incredible collage of a fertile musical imagination, and played so sympathetically, so idiomatically by the players of the Budapest Symphony Orchestra, led tonight by their concertmaster Giovanni Guzzo. Well, the premiere of Mahler's first symphony, conducted by Mahler in Budapest, while Mahler was in charge of the opera there for a few years. This performance by the Budapest Festival Orchestra, given by conductor Ivan Fischer, who also, incidentally, is the founder of the Hungarian Mahler Society. Well, I don't know how, but they've got to come on stage again in 45 minutes and do it all over again, although we will be seeing the lighter side of these players. Just under an hour they have to regroup, have a quick cuppa. All taking applause now, bows for Ivan Fischer, carrying a very large bouquet of red roses as he sprints off stage. Yes, they've got 50 minutes or so to have a quick cuppa, perhaps a stiff drink, which they have certainly earned. They've got to turn themselves around, come right back on stage here at the Royal Albert Hall. It is our audience choice prompt. If you are in the audience, you get to decide what this orchestra plays. We are promised by Ivan Fischer a tuba, roving the aisles, raffle tickets, possibly some cuddly toys, several very busy librarians trying to hand out all the right parts. Section applause for trombones and trumpets there. And the symphonists too. And for the basses, fantastic, wonderful low bass sound, giving support to that huge symphonic collage there. Everybody now on their feet. So if you want to hear more from this fabulous orchestra, we ask you to join us. Catherine Bock will be here for that second concert, 10 o'clock. But for now, it's time for me to hand you back to John Shea at Broadcasting House.
Susie, thank you very much. That was Susie Klein presenting the first of tonight's two proms by the Budapest Festival Orchestra. And you've another chance to hear that concert on Sunday afternoon here on BBC Radio 3 at 2 o'clock. Or, of course, you can use the iPlayer to listen to it again anytime you like over the next 7 days. bbc.co.uk/radio3.
The final week of the 2011 BBC Proms season continues with Seven Heavenly Bodies. Holst's evergreen masterpiece, The Planets. The BBC Symphony Orchestra and conductor David Robertson are also joined by violinist Christian Tetzlaff for an eagerly awaited UK premiere of a new concerto by Sir Harrison Birtwistle. Wednesday night at the BBC Proms, starting at 7 o'clock.
Well, before that, we have Prom Live from the Royal Albert Hall tomorrow night, given by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales. It's British first half, Elgar's Cocaine Overture, the first London performance of Michael Barclay's Organ Concerto. David Good is the soloist in that. And after the interval, Marc-André Amelin plays Rachmaninoff's Rhapsody on a theme of Paganini. And Kodály's Hari Janos Suite ends the programme. So that's live from the Proms tomorrow night on Radio 3, beginning at the earlier than usual time of 7 o'clock. But back with Mahler in between tonight's two Proms, in 5 minutes or so, we'll be Walking with Freud, a record of the recreation, I should say, of the only recorded meeting between Mahler and Freud in the summer of 1910. That's our feature in 5 minutes or so. So before then, let's hear Marc-André Amelin, tomorrow night's solo pianist, on disc. This is a recording he's made recently of music by Nikolai Roslovets. From 1914, these are three compositions.
Thank you.
Music by the Russian composer Nikolai Roslavets. That's not actually a recent recording, as I said earlier. Marc-André Amelin made that recording, in fact, in the late 1990s. And those were three compositions from 1914 by Nikolai Roslavets. And as I mentioned, you can hear Marc-André Amelin as the soloist tomorrow night at the Prom, playing Rachmaninoff's Rhapsody on a theme of Paganini. And there's more piano music in Monday night's Prom.
She made her BBC Proms debut a decade ago. Now she returns to London's Royal Albert Hall to play the same work in 2011. Pianist Hélène Grimaud plays Beethoven's evergreen fourth piano concerto in the first of a pair of concerts by the Pittsburgh Symphony and its current music director, Manfred Honeck. I'm Susie Klein. Join me this Monday night at 7:30 here on BBC Radio 3.
This is BBC Radio 3, where the time is now 9:15. And with the sound of Mahler's First Symphony still fresh in our ears, we come to this evening's feature, a second chance to hear Walking with Freud. On the 26th of August 1910, Gustav Mahler met Sigmund Freud, by arrangement, in a café in the Dutch city of Leiden. This is the only recorded meeting between these two great men from Vienna. They then spent 4 hours walking around the city, talking as they went. 100 years later, in the summer of 2010, the psychoanalyst Anthony Cantle, fellow of the Institute of Psychoanalysis in London and a member of the Gustav Mahler Society, met in Leiden with the composer David Matthews, thus recreating this meeting between Freud and Mahler. During that summer of 1910, Mahler had been working on his 10th symphony, but it was left incomplete when he died the following year. David Matthews helped with the orchestration of Derek Cook's performing version of Mahler's 10th symphony, and so he will forever be linked with this great masterpiece.
Almost exactly 100 years ago, in August 1910, Mahler came here to meet Freud, to consult him about the breakdown of his marriage. His wife, Alma, was having an affair with Walter Gropius. This has absolutely shattered him. And he was in a terrible state. And he was persuaded that it would be a good idea to come and talk to Freud, which he did. And he came to Leiden because Freud was on holiday nearby, and he was willing to interrupt his holiday to meet and talk with Mahler. Mahler, a very famous man, as Freud knew, and so that was enough for Freud to break his holiday where he didn't see patients. And for Mahler, it was a very long, arduous journey from Toblach, his summer home, a night's journey in a train, and he would return immediately after the consultation back to Toblach. So it was a very, it was quite an undertaking for both of them to have this talk, a very important talk. I've been influenced, I know, by Mahler in my own composing, and I very much sympathise with him as a composer. I mean, his attitude to music is something that I share, where you really put your life into your music. I mean, I know exactly what that means, because I feel the same about music, really. I've come to Leiden to meet the psychoanalyst Anthony Cantrell, and together we're going to recreate Freud's and Mahler's walk around the town, and we're going to discuss what they talked about, what they might have talked about, and how it benefited Mahler, and what it meant to Freud.
Hello, David. Hello. Hello.
I hope you had a good journey.
I did, and I think I shall refer to you from this point on as Herr Mahler.
Yes, I came like Mahler by train.
Yes.
I don't think you came by tram.
No. I incurred an increasing carbon footprint and took a plane to Amsterdam and then a fast train to Leiden.
And it's a lovely day here. We're sitting in a cafe by a canal, very quiet at the moment.
Much as we understand Mahler and Freud did 100 years ago. So Freud is here on holiday, about 10 miles from Leiden, tram ride away, about an hour's length. He's having his annual vacation on the coast. A difficult time for him. He's exhausted. He's had a long analytic year, stopping work, curiously and interestingly, as I did myself just before this weekend. Most analysts taking the August break. I think Mahler's arrived about 4:30 in Leiden, and they walk until sunset around the canals and the streets. So it's just a one-off meeting.
Mahler, in common with many artists, I think, was rather suspicious of psychoanalysis.
Yeah.
We do have something he said about it. He said, Freud, he tries to cure everything from one particular standpoint, i.e. sex, I suppose. But I think that he was rather reluctant to put himself under an analyst, in case, in fact, the productive neuroses which drove his composition disappeared and he was no longer able to compose.
We do know that Mahler was offered 3 appointments, cancelled the first 2. Analysts like myself would see that as not at all unusual, a rather healthy ambivalence and terror and fear of what a psychoanalytic consultation might involve. And then he finally accepts the third meeting here in Leiden. It's also, I think, important to understand that at the same time, whatever those terrors or worries may have been for Mahler in seeking Freud's help, he was also a working musician, a conductor. He'd settled the rehearsals and the other work connected with the 8th and was busy looking and working on the 10th symphony. That's right, isn't it, David?
Yes, yes. I mean, he was composing absolutely intensely. He produced the whole score of what he did in a matter of 6 or 7 weeks. It's something like 167 pages, I think, of manuscript. It's an extraordinary amount.
Yes.
And a piece lasting 1 hour and 20 minutes.
So he would have had other reasons other than internal anxieties and terrors for delaying the meeting. These two men have many things in common, both from similar areas on the Czech-Moravian-Bohemian border, non-observant Jews, but steeped nevertheless in Jewish culture.
Both Mahler and Freud were first sons, weren't they?
Yes. And favourite.
And favourites, yes. There was a child before Mahler who died in childbirth,
yes.
But Mahler was the first survivor and therefore became the favourite son,
yes.
As Freud did.
Yes. One of 14 children.
Mahler was one of 14 children, yes. 8 of whom died in infancy.
Yes.
And then 2 more died later. He had a favourite brother, Ernst, who died when he was 13.
Yes.
And then he had another brother who committed suicide.
Yes, yes.
So it was a tragic upbringing, absolutely tragic.
And we see that, don't we, in all of his compositions.
Yes.
This constant thematic emphasis on sorrow, death, loss,
yes.
Dying, suffering.
But also on overcoming it.
Yes.
Making some sense of life.
Yes, yes. I'm so glad you said that, David, because this is my own reading about Mahler's tremendous contribution through his music, what I would call the language of achievement, that which transcends that nihilistic despair that one could easily forgive him for collapsing in the face of, that he actually was able to bring through his music such a sense of achievement and understanding through loss and suffering.
Yes.
The other interesting thing, which has certainly puzzled me, and I think it's unprecedented for Freud, why did he agree to meet someone on vacation? Now, of course, what he said to colleagues is that he couldn't resist an attempt to help a man of Mahler's worth.
A man like Mahler,
he said, Mahler, yes, indeed.
Yeah. I mean, he was interested in genius, wasn't he, the idea of genius. He'd just written his book about Leonardo.
Yes, that's right.
Obviously, yes, a man like Mahler. I mean, yes. Mahler's the most famous man in Vienna.
Yes.
How could Freud resist it?
And more famous than Freud at that time. That's very important.
Certainly,
that
yes.
we should understand that Mahler was more well-known and more successful. Freud on his way up, as it were,
yes.
But some years yet to come for his major works.
Yes, it had taken Freud a long time, really. Freud was older than Mahler. Freud was 54, Mahler was 50.
54, Mahler 50, yes.
For both of them, the prevailing anti-Semitism in Austria was a hindrance. But I think that both of them overcame it absolutely, didn't they? But I mean, I can ask you this, Anthony. Was psychoanalysis attacked in its early days for being a peculiarly Jewish thing?
I think it wasn't so much attacked, but I think the suspicion was there that it was associated with Jews. And psychoanalysis and Judaism cannot be separated. The history is indivisible. But I think its primary challenge lay in the ideas that Freud had, which were absolutely revolutionary, particularly and controversially so, the idea of infantile sexuality. This was unheard of, people wouldn't speak of it, it was thought to be very, very controversial. So this was a man and a craft viewed with considerable suspicion, not, I think, particularly because Freud being a Jew, but because of his ideas.
Yes. During their four-hour conversation, Mahler obviously revealed a great deal about his own life to Freud, but one wonders if Mahler would have learned anything about Freud from him. Would Freud have spoken about his own life, do you think, at all, to encourage Mahler, perhaps?
Almost certainly not. He probably would have said a little bit, but not a great deal. The conventional and wholly unreasonable idea of a psychoanalyst being a complete blank screen, neutrality on two legs, is not the case. But Freud would have been discreet and thoughtful, and as a distinctive feature of any psychoanalyst, would have wanted to keep in mind who the patient was, who mattered most. So would have kept himself out of the picture in order to create a reasonably good opportunity for Mahler to feel free to speak. And we should say, I think, as well, that one very, very popular myth that has gone around is that Mahler was analysed by Freud. Mm. And, of course, what we're talking about here today is that it occurred, this meeting, once. They only met the once for 4 hours, as we've said. And they walked and they talked, a kind of, not a walking cure, but an analytic consultation conversation, not an analysis. We understand by psychoanalysis nowadays a daily meeting 4 or 5 times a week, in Freud's time perhaps on Saturdays as well, 6 days a week, for 50 minutes duration. So we are miles away from what would constitute an orthodox, ordinary psychoanalysis, these two men meeting only for the afternoon. Freud himself said of Mahler that he'd never met anyone who grasped psychoanalysis so quickly and so enthusiastically as Mahler had. Freud recognised that there was some real ability there. Mahler thought himself about his unconscious as a second self and spoke of it in that way.
Yes, he did. I think Mahler was quite unusual in understanding the workings of the unconscious in music.
Yes.
His statements about that. He made a very interesting statement to his friend Natalie Bauer-Lechner about how, when he was writing his Fourth Symphony, how he was able to pick it up 10 months later and start it again as if he'd been writing yesterday, acknowledging that it was there present in his unconscious all throughout the winter months. And then he could just take up his pen and start again without any problem. I think as a composer, I would certainly agree with Mahler about trying to express a truth about everything I know. And in a way, I do see my music as a kind of autobiography. I express things. I express things that I feel the best I can do. And it's also absolutely vital to me. I don't know what I would do if I didn't. I think I might need psychoanalysis if I didn't compose. But I think that it keeps me sane.
I mean, I must say, just sitting here on a Sunday morning in this beautiful part of Leiden, sun shining, these historic buildings, the canal site, it's really wonderful to be here, to have the opportunity to also to be in a place where, for each of us, for Mahler and Freud, in our different views and ways about it in relation to both, where they were 100 years ago. This street, to my mind, feels the kind of street that Mahler and Freud might have walked along, with these wonderful cobbles and wrought iron lampposts.
Yes, no sign of the car anywhere.
No.
From Mahler, walking was a very important activity. He went for a walk every day, and he thought about his music, I'm sure, on those walks, as I do. And myself, I find walking very great stimulus to composing, to getting ideas for compositions.
He was a tremendously athletic man, and those who knew him and who've written about his physique and his capacities for quite strenuous swimming and walking.
And bicycling, too.
And bicycling, yes. David, look, let's not get any further in this walk without mentioning Alma Mahler.
Yes, Alma was an extraordinary woman who Mahler met when she was 19, and a great beauty, and a very intelligent woman who'd had bohemian education, really. So she was brought up in the world of artists. As a teenager, she had a relationship, and it wasn't a full-blown affair, with Klimt. And she'd had a love affair with Alexander von Zemlinsky, the composer, the teacher of Schoenberg, who gave her composition lessons. She was really quite a promising young composer when Mahler met her. She'd written what I think are really quite outstanding songs for a girl of her age, and she wanted to be a composer. Mahler met her, and he was bowled over by her, by her beauty and by her brains.
But not enough to tolerate, apparently, her own creativity.
No.
And it was a condition of marriage, wasn't it? Yes, cease her own composing.
That's right, they got engaged. Mahler sent her a long letter stating quite precisely what he expected of her. And one of the things was that she should give up her composing because he said, you can't have two composers in the same. You can't have two composers who are married to each other, really.
I think he put it, didn't he? I want a wife, not a colleague.
Yes. And that was a terrible thing for Alma, really, but she accepted it. She accepted it because she wanted to get married to Mahler. She was conscious of Mahler's status, and she saw herself as becoming an important person in Vienna, even more than she was at the time. I mean, she was already quite a star, but she would have become a greater star, obviously, marrying the most famous man in Vienna, which she did, and she sacrificed that. Mm-hmm. We know that she resented it from her diaries, but she put up with it, and she became, although she wasn't an ideal Hausfrau, she became Mahler's wife, and it seemed to be quite happy, the marriage, for the first 5 years. Mm-hmm. They had two daughters. But although he recognized Alma's intelligence, he thought her opinions were very naive. And yes. He writes about this at great length in that long letter.
Yes.
You're not really a developed person. In other words, really, you've got nothing much to say yet, and you've got to learn a lot more. But he wasn't really prepared to help her. He already assigned her to a role which she accepted, but with reluctance. Mm. And that reluctance became stronger and stronger. Anyway, their marriage was really fulfilled and happy, in more or less.
Yes. On those conditions.
On those conditions.
Yes, yes.
Until the terrible thing that happened in 1907.
Which would be the death of Putzi,
yes,
the first child.
Yes, to whom Mahler was absolutely devoted.
Yes, and this child would have been about 4 and a half,
yes,
who died, sadly, from diphtheria. So sad. And this daughter to whom he was devoted and adored. And I think it says something about the rather narcissistic Alma that we're discussing and thinking about, that she was in her own way, and does actually admit to this in her diaries, that she felt very competitive, quite rivalrous, quite envious, I think, of the relationship between Putzi and Mahler. And one might speculate, I think a therapist, an analyst would certainly do so, about the kind of guilt and the kind of miserable feelings that Alma would have experienced after the death of someone whom privately and secretly she perceived as a rival, albeit only a tiny child, but the love of her father for his daughter. And
what we don't know, I think, is whether they really satisfactorily worked out the loss in their marriage. Interestingly, Mahler's letters to her in 1907 and afterwards are always maintain this cheerful note. He never once mentions in her letters, I hope you're okay, and he doesn't say that sort of thing.
No,
he just talks on this in this usual either cheerful or high flown tone, talking about philosophy and so on and the things that had happened to him. But he doesn't actually. It's not. They're not very. In some ways, they're a bit impersonal, those letters.
Absolutely, strongly privileging denial about what had happened.
Yes.
And one gets the impression when, I think about this now, what we would do in relation to a couple who'd lost a child. The idea that in 1907, where would they go? Nowadays, we would think very automatically that they would seek help, counselling, psychotherapy for their joint loss. Mm. One has a sense, when I read the literature about this, that Mahler took himself off to work and could do so and had this enormously important outlet, this place to sink his grief, his suffering, his own angst. But what of Alma? Now, whatever we make of her and whatever we think about her, and she will have been a mother, first and last, who had suffered the loss of a child. And one has a sense that she probably had to bear this pretty much alone.
Alma calls him a psychopath,
yes,
in her memoirs.
Yes.
And that's why he decided to consult Freud. This is an extraordinary phrase to use. But I mean, she wasn't... I have to say that Mahler was a very difficult man maybe to live with, but she was almost impossible. There were aspects of her character which were very, very difficult to accept. I mean, her need to be at the centre of things, to be a princess all the time, in the limelight, to create dramatic situations,
yes,
to actually live her life like a novel. And if there weren't situations to be created, she would make them up. She would,
yes,
make them
to
restore herself to the center stage where she felt,
yes,
she belonged. That was very hard to deal
with.
She
had a palpable narcissism, that's true, and was histrionic in the extreme, and
yes,
did pretty much see herself as,
yes,
the center of,
yes,
the universe. I think what's very interesting about her description of her husband is actually the projection of her own psychopathy. In other words, one of the things that Alma certainly wasn't distracted by or suffered very much from was a sense of guilt, which is the hallmark of the psychopathic personality, an affectionless response where true guilt and understanding and empathy with someone else
would be very limited, if non-existent.
When Marla found out about the affair, she didn't apologise at all. I mean, she started accusing Marla, saying it was all his fault that had made her turn to someone else.
Yes, yes.
And this heightened Marla's insecurity. It heightened his anguish.
Yes.
And she did nothing to alleviate that, it seems.
That's right. I'm just thinking about my own clinical experience, where one would perhaps see a couple in a situation such as the Marlers found themselves, in which it's a very, very familiar device where the betraying spouse would try and foster and promote ideas and insecurities in the betrayed. I mean, one aspect in which we might find some compassion for Alma is something about how she managed her own losses. We know that she lost her father at a very crucial age, on the cusp of adolescence, to whom she was very attached and devoted. She lost this younger child of 4.5. So one has a sense that what does someone do? What did Alma do? And my own view always has been that what I think of and call Alma's signature tune is of a gross sexualization, an enactment and a defense against her own loss, the evasion and avoidance of her own mourning because of all the terrible things that happened in her own life. Now, of course, this is terrible and drove Marla perhaps nearly mad and other people as well. She was a tormentor and a narcissist, but there's no doubt that that perhaps is one of her ways of managing her own equilibrium, alcohol and sex.
Alcohol and sex, yes. Mm? We don't know whether she really enjoyed sex very much. It seems that she possibly didn't. She writes about it, you know, in her diaries as if she did, but then we can't believe really what necessarily anything she said. No. Well, some of it must be true. Yeah.
But in very gross sexualization, you would actually find that it wasn't the sex that was important. It wasn't the passion, the nourishment.
Yes.
It was the control, the usurping of the object, the incorporation of someone else, the sense of being connected with another, to do with presence and excitement, but very little to do with the other person. And a pleasure and an enjoyment. Mm. If there was pleasure, it would be a pleasure associated with being able to use her formidable seductive talents to a particular end of a kind of triumph, a conquest of other people.
Now we come to the summer of 1910, and Alma's in a very bad way. She's already drinking far too much. She ended her life as a real alcoholic. She used to drink a bottle of Benedictine a day, apparently. And in June 1910, she goes off by herself to a spa in Tobelbad, near Graz. And almost as soon as she arrives, she meets the young architect, Walter Gropius. And they fall in love, and she begins an affair with him. This was the first real affair she'd had. She'd flirted with others, but she embarks on a full-scale affair. And clearly it was very important to both of them, from the tone of their letters anyway. And Marla carries on writing the symphony and is in a terrible state. He's ill, he's crying, he's addressing poems to Alma, leaving them on her bed. He's in the most appalling condition.
She describes, doesn't she, that he's lying on the floor of the composing hut, writhing and crying.
Yes.
The prospect of losing her is just beyond him.
And he's in the position of a child calling for his mother.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
So something that interested me, we hear that by the time Marla met Freud here in Leiden, that it was prompted by the breakdown of his marriage. But, you know, I don't know what you think, David, but I think it's also prompted by Marla actually also, if not having, very close to breakdown himself.
I think so. It was almost suicidal, his
mood. Absolutely.
I don't think he would have ever
committed suicide. I think his will to live and to compose, to carry on composing, was always too strong for him to have done that. But he was absolutely desperate.
Yes.
What Freud says, Mahler came to consult him about, was that he could no longer love Alma in the way that he did.
Yes.
And a suggestion that he might have been impotent. I don't know whether he actually says impotent.
Withdrawn his libido, I think, was the...
Yeah, she no longer excited him, that's right.
Yes.
Yes. It's interesting, you know, he was obviously still devoted to her in a way. I mean, but maybe the sexual side just had and he just saw her as this muse figure.
Mm.
He idolized Alma.
Yes.
He put her on a pedestal. She was a goddess. You know, she would not betray him in this way. She betrayed him. And he couldn't take this.
And you see, I think that betrayal, David, was in proportion to the investment that Mahler had in this relationship. We would understand this in psychoanalytic language. We would think about this, the investment, the transference to his own wife. Who was Alma? Of course, she was Mrs. Mahler, but she was everything that this man was searching for and also felt he'd lost the love of his mother, his siblings, many other things in life, the loss of his daughter. So here is this woman who, when he discovers the betrayal and the affair, the terror of losing her and all that she psychically stood for, as I would think of it and others, as a container for his own mind, much in the same way that good mothering approximates to that of a mother with a child being able